Hey, amigos, you know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Please help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. And if you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in, give me a thumb. Say hello while you're at it. It helps me a ton with the algorithm. And besides, it's real nice to see you there. And now, on to the show. Welcome, friend. Always a pleasure to have you. First of all, happy Bootleggers Day. It's always worth celebrating when good citizens like Al Capone tell the government to go fuck themselves. Oh, and happy birthday, Al Capone. No, Chester, he doesn't actually listen to the show. I'm sure he would if he were still around. But let's go on in, friend. We've got business to attend to. All right. So check out simplyscarypodcast.com and click the Patrons Area button. You can get our entire catalog ad-free and available to download or stream for a bargain price. It's highway robbery, to be honest. Anyway, tonight we welcome author A.W. Mason to the show by way of our friends at Velox Books. In this one, a dystopian American government is putting on a 20-mile road race, sponsored by a new reanimation company. The prize? A loved one brought back to life. And like all government programs, it goes off without a hitch. It's called sarcasm, Chester. Hey, how did you get in here anyway? Oh, fuck it. Just stay quiet, okay? Without further delay, amigos, from author A.W. Mason, I give you 20 Mile Chances. It was Tuesday when I first saw the giant screen flash the advertisement. The screen, perhaps 10 stories tall and as long as a football field, reminded me of the one that used to be in Times Square, a place I studied in history lessons as a child, but never had the chance to visit before it was destroyed. The big cities burned first. New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Dallas. It wasn't a sudden thing, and it wasn't a quick thing, but rather an event that took years of tension, malicious rhetoric, and sanctions against our political adversaries before war flooded America like a burst dam. This all happened when my parents were still young, before I was even thought of. It was also the first time since yet another archaic war, Vietnam if I recall correctly, that the draft was reinstated. Unluckily for my father, he was part of the second wave of draftees called up once he came of age. Now, obviously, he didn't die right away. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here to tell you this story. In fact, while he was fighting in the war, he and my mother wed, and while on leave, consummated their marriage. And as a result, here I am. All this, a decade after he had been drafted, and close to 15 years since the war had begun. However, my father did die. I was 4 years old. My mother received a call from the vice president himself with the news and a quick thank you for his service. Ironically, the vice president was assassinated not a year after, along with the president and most of his cabinet, in an orchestrated coup by our own military. It seems our political adversaries had infiltrated the administration to the point of installing their own New America government. At least that's what I read about in the history books growing up, and gleaned from secondhand stories my mother and her side of the family told when we were able to get together. New America, for the most part, is all I've ever known. Now, I'm not saying it's Orwellian by any means, but the stories my uncles have told me, tales of democracy and freedom of expression and about a million other things, those ideals are starkly different from anything that I've learned in any school curriculum. But here I am. I'm provided for. I've been placed into the workforce. I have a wife now and a child. There's no more war, and if you adhere to the state regulations, you should be free of any trouble. I get to see my mother and my uncles about once a month. I wish it were more, but that's just the way things are. I value that time, however, because it's through them that I've been able to create an image of my father, one that I'm old enough now to understand and appreciate. I know it isn't the same as having him here. I regret that he's gone. I miss him a hell of a lot. But he would have to live on in spirit alone, and I'd come to accept that. That was until Tuesday when I read the advertisement that slowly scrolled along the giant screen downtown. I had just gotten off work. 9 solid hours of data mining had my mind close to mush, and I was looking forward to a run when I arrived home. The New American Coalition was high on fitness, just as much as technology, so when I saw the screen before I got on the bus ride home, I stopped dead in my tracks and reread the scrawl maybe a dozen times. 20 miles. 10K shy of a marathon. Not far considering the reward. A coalition subsidiary, Left and Reanimation Corps, was sponsoring a 20-mile race, which in and of itself wasn't much surprising considering our mandatory physical training. But this particular alphabet agency focused on a technology that I hadn't thought possible. Resurrection. And that was the reward. Win the race, bring back to life a soul who passed on. Although later many folks thought the event was just a big marketing ploy to show off the new technology to the rest of the world. I saw the chance to see my father again. The entire bus ride home, I pondered the possibilities. My father meeting his grandson, his daughter-in-law, seeing his own wife again. I thought about hugging him, actually holding on to him, something more than a memory. There would be so much to cover, so much to talk about. The New American Coalition, antebellum memories, and post-war living. I walked into my home, still considering the likelihood of this special chance. My wife, Lena, had just got home as well from her position at the Coalition's welfare facility, and I told her about what I had discovered. With her support, I sat down at the computer module in the corner of the living room and logged into LRC's platform site to read the details of the event. Pretty simple, I thought. The race would be a televised event, sponsored by the Coalition and LRC to award a victor the opportunity to bring back a deceased person from their family. It had to be a familial relation due to the necessity of DNA formulation between the departed and the living. That worked out perfect in my book. The race was limited to 25 participants, and they would be chosen based on a lottery draw. If selected, participants would have a week to train before the race was held, which would be in 2 weeks' time at Hayworth Park. The remaining guidelines were vague. No age or class divisions. No restrictions on gear or supplements, if you had any access to them. I entered my name, submitted the form, pushed myself away from the monitor, and stared. My mind swam with fantastic scenarios. Being chosen. Becoming the victor. Seeing my father again. Sleep that night came slowly. My brain wouldn't shut off, regardless of the sheep I counted. Work the next day was rough, but I labored through it, and honestly, the week after seemed like a blur. Every day before traveling home, I read the LRC race advertisement, hoping like hell the entrants would be few and my chances of being chosen would be many. On draft day, I rolled out of bed after a sleepless night filled with anxiety about being selected. I pushed around the powdered eggs and toast on my plate, my appetite gone, vacationing somewhere with the sleep I needed. The television in the background finally finished up with the state news and segued into the chairman from LRC thanking the coalition for the race sponsorship. On the screen, the chairman reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a rectangular piece of paper. The names. I shoved my plate away, stood up, and walked over to the television. Lena crept up behind me as our son Nathan still slept soundly down the hall. She wrapped her arms around my midsection and waited with me for the lucky participants to be called.
"And now for the moment most of you have been waiting for,"
the chairman began.
"LRC has randomly chosen 25 citizens from the thousands of you who so graciously entered the lottery."
My heart sank a little. I knew there would be plenty of folks interested in signing up, but I wanted so badly for the draft pool to be as small as possible.
"Our first participant is Sean O'Hara. Next, we have Gregory Arbuckle, followed by Jennifer Milton,"
the chairman said from his podium on the screen. Lena's hold around me became tighter as more names were read off, the total drawing closer to the 25. I sighed and closed my eyes as the chairman prepared to call out the final name.
"And lucky number 25 is Antonio Torres. I want to personally thank each and every one of you who entered. Do not be disheartened if your name was not called. Instead, have comfort in knowing that one of these participants will soon have the opportunity of a lifetime."
Lena kissed the back of my neck as I switched off the television. She released me, gently turned me around, and stared into my eyes. Her look said everything I needed to see. A message without words that lovers could share after years and years of practice. I pulled her into me, living in her warmth, and said, "It's probably for the best." All week long, I buried myself in my work. I stayed late and avoided the water cooler talk as well as the continuous commotion of LRC's race hype. Admittedly, I was still sour about the situation. I had gotten my hopes up when I knew that I should have been smarter. Lena kept Nathan occupied as I worked on even more data mining from the home computer to keep my mind off the race. It would fade, this feeling of envy and depression, but for now, I needed to keep myself busy. On Thursday of that week, I was back at my home computer, crunching numbers for the coalition. Lena was in the living room reading a picture book to Nathan as the television streamed ambient in the background. However, a familiar sound, the sound of the state news breaking into regular broadcast with a special bulletin, chimed its way into my ears. I got up from my workstation and sat on the couch with Lena and Nathan. Nathan patted my arm and smiled up at me. His sandy hair and cherub-like cheeks looked a lot like the photographs of myself when I was around his age. Only his eyes were different. His eyes were my father's eyes.
"We apologize for interrupting your regularly scheduled broadcast, but we have a dire announcement to make. Tamika Harris, participant number 19 for Saturday's LRC's 20-mile race, has suddenly perished. Details at this hour are scarce, but is believed that Harris suffered a heart attack while training for the competition and did not recover."
Lena, eyes still on the television, squeezed my forearm.
"There will be an emergency drawn from the pool of entrants who were not initially chosen to act as her replacement. Please stand by for contact from the coalition, and of course, we will all keep Tamika Harris in our thoughts. Thank you. We will now return you."
The phone rang. Lena's grip on my forearm tightened, almost to the point of a tingling numbness, and we looked at each other. The phone rang again. Neither of us moved. Neither of us could move. It felt like an eternity before the next ring echoed through the foyer. I sprang up, knocking Nathan's picture book from Lena's lap, and ran to the phone. Light from the hall seemed to cast a spotlight on the beige plastic handset in front of me. Light from the hall seemed to cast a spotlight on the beige plastic handset in front of me. I grasped the receiver and answered.
"Hello?"
"Hello, yes. May we speak with a Mr. Kensington Campbell?"
asked a voice on the other end of the phone.
"Hi, yes. This is Ken speaking."
"Great. Mr. Campbell, my name is Gordon Frederick, and I'm reaching out to you on behalf of the Left and Reanimation Corps. As I'm sure you are aware, we have a slot open in our upcoming event, the 20-mile race this Saturday at Hayworth Park, due to some most unfortunate circumstances.
I paused, swallowed, and tried to speak.
Yes. Yes, I've just heard, actually.
I looked at Lena, whose eyes had widened to the size of large steel ball bearings.
Great. Well, we were perusing our list of candidates from the lottery pool, and your name was randomly chosen after we had a few entrants decline to replace our fallen runner. Can we count on you to fill the position? I know it's such a drearily short notice. Not much time to train, I'm afraid, but just think of the potential reward.
My heartbeat made a crescendo in my chest. Sweat stood out in droplets above my eyebrows. A cool chill surged throughout my body. My throat was dry, but I licked my lips and was able to respond.
Yes, yes, of course,
I replied. I happened to glance at Lena again, who smiled back at me so wide I could see her perfectly white molars.
Great,
the phone voice said again.
All the information you will need regarding arrival time and race day preparations will be sent to your state email address. Please check your home computer in a few minutes to review and accept the terms. Questions can be directed to the phone number listed in the email. And thank you, Mr. Campbell, for accepting this greatest of opportunities. We look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
Before I could respond, before I could say thank you, the line clicked off and went dead. I placed the phone receiver back into its cradle and looked at my wife. We both had tears running their courses down our cheeks, dumb smiles catching the salty rivers. The Coalition granted me Friday off from work for the purpose of race preparation, what little I could do in a day. I was lucky to have taken to the state's mandatory fitness program so enthusiastically. My endurance felt good. 20 miles wasn't out of the realm of possibility for me to finish, although I didn't have any information on the folks I'd be racing against. Instead, I decided to focus on myself, mentally prepare, and try to get as much rest as I could. I knew sleep would be a challenge for me if I got any at all, so I decided to turn in early in hopes that the Sandman would visit. When my alarm went off early Saturday morning, I was surprised and a little disconnected from a deep sleep as I slapped at the device to cease its bleating. Feeling more rested than anticipated, I arose, stretched my arms, and went to turn on the shower. Steam quickly fogged the mirror, and I could hear Lena already off in the kitchen preparing my breakfast. On the bathroom sink counter, there was a jar of petroleum jelly, which after the shower, I applied to any area of my body that friction normally occurred. For longer runs, chafing and bleeding could cut your progress to the point of crawling in raw pain. I dressed in my state-issued tech fabric racewear and carefully tied a bandana around my brow to protect my bald head from sunburn. Lena had placed a plate on the table with slices of fresh mango, avocado, and wheat toast. Nathan sat in his high chair across from me, sucking milk from his sippy cup. A small pale rivulet flowed from the corner of his mouth. He burped, then laughed. Nathan, regardless of most situations, seemed to always have the innate ability to bring a smile to my face. And how I hoped like hell my own father would see the joy that this child brings me. The Coalition sent a private car to retrieve my family. The trip was a short one. Hayworth Park was a mere 10 miles from our house. What I saw when we crested the sloping hill into the park went beyond what I had imagined race day would hold in store. Thousands of cheering spectators lined the path to the race entrance, waving small handheld New America flags. They cheered into the overcast morning. Riser seating had been constructed and placed for what looked like great lengths of the course. The state news outlet had already begun their on-site broadcast for the event, and I even spied foreign press, a rarity for the Coalition to allow. Wide electric screens flanked the seat and risers, showing the race coverage as it unfolded. Above me, I heard a helicopter hovering. The driver pulled away from the front of the park and into a corded-off staging area where we were instructed to exit the car and check in with the concierge of the platform near the end of a big white tent. From there, Lena and Nathan were consigned to a family viewing area, and I was corralled into a room with the other runners who had already arrived. When the final participant joined us minutes later, the chairman entered from a door flap in the big white tent structure, and the room became silent. The chairman walked in and stood before us, smiling.
"Good morning, race contestants. I'm sure you're all very anxious to get this race started, so let me not keep you too long."
The chairman began.
"We at LRC have developed a cutting-edge technology, one we want to share with the world and, of course, one that we want to share with you. We want to reconnect you with people from your past, people you may have never met, people you may have never had a chance to say goodbye to or say I love you to one last time. This new technology is going to change not only New America as we know it, but it's going to change the world. So, why have a race to showcase our new discovery? It's very simple. Money. This research and development has created a huge cost, and the more we develop this technology, the greater that cost will be. Hopefully, in the years to come, it will become more affordable for everyone. But now, with this event and the worldwide exposure you will all likely create, the funds necessary to continue our cause will be raised to a global level, and we will have investors lining up at our proverbial door. We are also a philanthropic body, aren't we? We want to give the chance to one of our loyal citizens to experience this technology free of charge. Really, for you and for the coalition, it's a win-win situation. Listen to me rambling on. I apologize. And before we disperse, what questions may there be?"
For a short time, the room remained silent. The runners stood like statues, myself included, either in awe of what was about to happen or in shock that they were one of the 25 people competing in this unique competition. I was part of the latter, but an arm shot up in the back. The chairman nodded to a scrawny, pimply-faced kid who couldn't have been much older than 18.
"Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman. I read through the event contract and signed it with enthusiasm. However, I was poring over it again last night, reading the fine print, if you will. The section under regulations stated that this is a non-regulated sanctioned event. What does that mean exactly?"
the kid asked. The chairman smiled, exposing a neat row of square teeth. I could have sworn that at that moment, his eyes narrowed to slits and the devil himself had manifested in the man. It wasn't far from the truth, knowing what I know now.
"These people, these viewers, and the world at large want to see a show, don't they? It can only dramatically increase the, exposure for what our endeavor serves. This is indeed a non-regulated sanctioned event. That means you have the freedom, and I do underline that word, freedom, to compete how you see fit. Whatever works best for you. Each racer must run the full 20 miles, but how you get to the finish line, well, that's up to you,"
the chairman said. A murmur among the contestants broke out. The pimply-faced kid raised his hand again, and once more the chairman nodded to him.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Is there any other clarification you can give us on that?"
"Why, sure,"
the chairman said, the smile dropping from his face.
"Now, we're not condoning or suggesting you go out and commit heinous acts of violence against one another,"
he began, winking dramatically at the crowd.
"But if someone were to trip, maybe accidentally knocked over, well, the race isn't going to stop."
A tall man with a stone face dressed in a black suit leaned in toward the chairman and whispered into his ear. The chairman nodded, patted the man on the back, and turned back toward us.
I've just been informed that it's time to shuffle you out to the starting line. Once again, I thank you for your participation. And just keep in mind all the good you're about to do for the Coalition. Good luck to you all, and may the best man or woman be victorious.
The chairman exited the podium, pausing to relay something to the same stone-faced man from earlier. The man nodded and walked through our crowd to the back. We were ushered single file from the tent, and as I approached the exit flap, I craned my neck behind me, seeing not only the other solemn-looking souls, but also the stone-faced man transfer something to a runner at the end of the line. It was a smooth transition, like a sleight of hand by a veteran magician, and I'm certain now that I must have been the only one to see it. What it was, on that I wasn't sure, but it glinted under the lights of the tent, the shiny metal quickly concealed by the runner's hand. I tried to speak up, to say something, but was guided forcefully by another man in a black suit toward the starting line. Outside, the skies remained their same shade of dirty gray, threatening to rain. The crowds were raucous, and the giant screens blared out the state's broadcast in deafening decibels. My vision blurred, my palms started to sweat. The noises around me became muffled. Shoulder to shoulder, I lined up next to my fellow runners trying to focus on the race, but my mind fired off in a million different directions, pulled by phantom hands. We stood there in front of the raging crowd for what seemed like an eternity, until finally a shot rang out, cracking through the sky, signaling the start of the race. At first, I didn't move. Couldn't. I felt racers brushing past me, maneuvering around the spot in the ground that magnetized me. A runner pushed me from behind, breaking my trance, and my legs began to pump. The adrenaline coursed through my veins and my pace became too quick. I labored for breath, catching up to the running mob, and established my normal gait. Once I had settled down and found my pace, I scanned the area around me, noticing that the crowds lining the running course thinned out as we trudged farther along. The hovering cameras broadcasting the event live to a television audience across New America, and probably the world, kept pace with the front group, of which I was a part. Another hovering camera lagged behind, collecting images of those bringing up the rear. After 10 miles, it became clear who my real competition was. I stayed among the leaders, rotating within the top four as the miles added up. The crowds, now just sporadic pockets of people along the course, shouted out updates to us as we passed by them. Of the 25 entrants, 10 had quit, forfeited their chance at LRC's amazing reward, and three others ceased due to injury and muscle cramps. Still, I was a top five runner and hoped to keep my position at least until the last mile when I could really turn it on. And that was the only thing on my mind until I heard about the first death, occurring with 7 miles left. At first, I thought a runner must have suffered a massive stroke, or perhaps a heart attack like Tamika Harris had in her training. After all, those kinds of things did happen, and even to the fittest of people. I also didn't want to believe what the crowds were shouting to us, what the other runners swore they saw when they caught up to our grouping. And now when I think back to our pre-race speech with a clear mind, the claims made sense, as much as I wanted to think it was all just hearsay. A runner in the group behind me had been stabbed multiple times by another participant. The stone-faced man. The last runner in line. The transition of something that gleamed in the light. The facts added up. What the crowd relayed to us. What our fellow runners saw. The non-regulation statement. There was a madman on the course, and he was intent on slaughter. The runners that quit, scared off by the racer with the knife. The runners too injured to go on, cut up by the man the state media would later refer to as the mad knifer, a bit too juvenile for my taste. I wanted to press my pace, stake a distance between myself and the murdering maniac runner, but my endurance was nowhere near what I needed to sustain such a high speed and still finish the race. I had heard of the Coalition pulling stunts before, inserting moles to punish underperforming labor forces, using those poor souls as public examples to motivate all the other citizens under the state's thumb. The Coalition even believed in public executions to help further their law and order. But installing a knife-wielding runner among a group competing for the resurrection of a loved one, that seemed like a new low. And did I have to finish the race and risk being caught up to by this maniac? What would stop me from dropping out like some of the others had? Self-preservation topping all else. It was possible. I just had to leave the course and blend into the crowd and I'd be safe from the hunter. However, my bravado, my ego, told me otherwise. It told me I deserved this reward. It told me I deserved to see my father once more, to show him he was not forgotten. Even now, I think it was stupid, but damn it, I would do it again if I had to. At that point, my mind was made up. I would finish this race or die trying. Or kill to cross the line. Finish first at all costs. This wasn't a regulated event. Fuck New America. Fuck the Coalition. This was my race to win, and mine only. The crowd started to thicken along the course the closer we fought toward the finish line. The mass of spectators probably trying to catch a glimpse of the mad knifer gaining on the front runners. I kept a vigilant watch, scanning the other runners behind the lead group. It felt like we had padded the distance as we closed in on the end of the race. The marker denoting the final mile approached, and with it, my mind narrowed in on one thing only. Get across the finish line and get there first. I was in the lead, but I could see several runners in my peripheral, nipping at my heels. I could feel the hot sweat dripping down my face, soaking through my bandana. The crowd began to roar with excitement. The hand of the runner next to me shot out, tried to grip my forearm as the knife-wielding maniac plunged his weapon into the soft tissue of the runner's throat. A squirt of steaming blood splattered the side of my face as I turned to see more clearly the runner tumble to his knees, grasping at his neck. I looked to my right and witnessed another runner, stunned from the bloodletting we had both just witnessed, tangle up on his own feet and crash hard to the pavement. Adrenaline flushed through my body and a sheet of chills blanketed my skin. I turned my neck and chanced a glance behind me. I saw the runner with the knife, blood up to the hilt, flinging off the slick steel with every pump of his arm. He was 3 or 4 strides behind me. We were the only ones left. How had he caught up to me? Later, I forced myself to watch the rebroadcast of the run. The mad knifer made his way through the throng of runners with ease, starting from the back and methodically working his way forward as if stamina and endurance were of no issue to him. He closed the gap on the lead group with alarming quickness, and had I not been so focused that last mile on being the first across the finish line, I would have noticed the madman approaching me. After the two runners flanking me went down, it left the knifer and myself vying for the finish line. I could see it. It felt so close I thought I could touch it. Only what I actually felt was the hot breath of the madman on my neck as he drafted behind me. I saw the blade come down within inches of my shoulder. My body froze, my legs skidding to a halt. The madman tumbled over me at full speed, sprawling out on the pavement while taking me down with him. I hit my head, hard enough to see hundreds of little stars, and felt a sticky substance covering my left eye. The gash in my forehead flowed like a river and partially blinded me, but I saw the knife mere feet from our collision. Instinct kicked in again, and I groped for the knife, picking it up as I straddled the exhausted man next to me. The blood from my forehead splashed down in droplets onto his cheeks. He braced my wrists with his hands as I hovered the knife inches above his face. We both trembled, muscles aching as I threw my chest over my hands, using the force and weight of my body to drive the blade into the madman's eyeball. It slid in with a sickening slurp, and a strange opaque fluid filled the reservoir of where his eye used to be when it finally popped. The screams from the madman mixed with the screams from the crowd surrounding us, and I couldn't differentiate between them. The knife finally came to a rest with an inch of the blade still exposed as the man fell limp. I don't remember crossing the finish line. I watched myself do it on the rebroadcast, but I still don't remember it. The crowds cheered me on as I walked across. My head hung and I was crying. I killed a man who tried to kill me, and I was grieving for him. I killed a man for the chance to bring another man back, the gravity of which didn't hit me until days later, when I saw myself commit the heinous act. Sure, you could claim it was self-defense, but I could have easily popped up and run across the finish line with the knife in hand instead of turning it on the attacker. I would have won. I would have been safe. But I killed him. And I haven't stopped replaying that in my head. One night, a week later, my family and I were seated at the dinner table getting ready to dig into a tray of lasagna when the doorbell rang. My wife and I exchanged a glance and I got up to answer it. When I pulled the door open, I saw my father. Just the same as like looking at all the old photographs my mother had managed to keep. He had not aged a minute. The beard was the same. The glasses were the same. The thinning hairline, all the same. I tried to speak. My mouth opened, but no words came out. I heard a plate crash to the floor behind me as Lena saw the man at the door.
"Hello, son,"
my father said.
"Hello again."
Tears welled up in my eyes, blurring my vision and creating a duplicate of the man in front of me. I nodded my head and mouthed the word hello. I reached my arms out and embraced him as he stepped inside. I hugged the man that I hadn't seen or touched or smelled in years. I buried my face into his neck and cried, sobs hitching in my throat, and he pulled me in tighter. In the threshold of the door, we stood, arms wrapped around each other, and it felt like we had an eternity in that moment. And I was ready to experience that eternity. My father patted the back of my head and I tightened my embrace. I tightened until it felt like I was squeezing too hard. Too much as the body inside his flannel shirt started to waste away. The hand patting my head began to feel like a bag of feathers caressing my scalp. Before finally the sensation of sand blew across and down my neck. And I knew his hand was gone. My own hands collapsed in on each other. Wadding up my father's flannel shirt. His body had vanished. I pulled back and looked at my father's face one last time. He was still smiling as he turned dark, then ashy, and then disappeared. I dropped his shirt onto the pile with his jeans and sneakers below me. I fell to my knees. Lena came up behind me, placing her hands on my shoulders and her face on my back as I picked up my father's shirt again, held it to my face, and breathed in. I cried. A month later, I received a letter in the mail with the LRC letterhead. It congratulated me on my win and for my experience to interact with a resurrected loved one again. It went on to explain the technology wasn't perfect. They were still working out bugs, but have made great strides, and it was because of people like me that they were able to continue their research. It was obvious that the race was a bogus attempt to garner publicity for the state. They were, after all, God, and I was but a humble servant, a slave to my master who influenced my thoughts and dictated my decisions. To see my father again was an experience, even so briefly, that has helped the numbness of everyday life now. But, gone as soon as he arrived, it also reminded me of our own fragility and how delicate life is. I still see it sometimes, the blood on my hands. I wash and wash and wash until my skin is hot and raw. But it doesn't ever seem to come off. And that was 20 Mile Chances by A.W. Mason. A good reminder that if something's too good to be true, it probably is. A little about the author. A.W. Mason lives in Florida with his cats Wallace and Belle, retired extreme parkour artists who look so dapper in their little helmets and knee pads. He enjoys all the nachos, getting lost in the woods, and naps. Mason has published several books, including The Haunt of Travels, The Cleanup Crew, The Scamperin', co-authored with Alana K. Drex, and Judy Martin's Final Curtain Call. His short stories have appeared in various anthologies. If you enjoyed this story, be sure to visit VeloxBooks.com and pick up his book, A Haunt of Travels, also available on Audible. Thanks, A.W., and thank you, Velox Books.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, friend, at least till tomorrow. Be sure to visit me on the Sinister Somnolence channel for my new show, The Crimson Hour. Meanwhile, grab a drink for the road, and if you encounter any problems out there, just remember, stab first. So may the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. Oh, hit that like button on the way out, would you? Also, go fuck yourself. Good night, y'all.